KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture, the first show of the winter quarter on KZSU's schedule. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor of law at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Stanford Center for Computers and the Law fellow Aaron Kahana. Aaron is also special counsel at the Maslin Law Firm in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and we're going to be chatting today about some work that Aaron's been doing over the last couple of years through CODEX, the acronym for the Center for Computers and the Law at Stanford, involving artificial intelligence and more specifically issues involving intent and artificial intelligence ability to catch up with human brain power and what that means for the law. I met Aaron at this point about a year ago, give or take, at a conference at Stanford where he was talking about his work. He used some very, I think, stark and interesting media involving a variety of previews and promotional materials for the movie Prometheus, and I think I'm going to ask Aaron a bit about that as well. But following on that work, Aaron's been writing in the area, focusing on, and we're going to be focusing today, on some work he's doing on abstract thought and IP infringement, that is intellectual property infringement. Again, the concept being that as we are increasingly able to develop abilities for computers to not only engage in logical thinking, but in abstract reasoning, and indeed to learn, what does that mean for the law? What does that mean particularly for things like intent, where we're talking about the mental state traditionally of an individual, but now we're talking about, in a broad sense, the mental state, if you will, of a computer or of a robot. And the law, of course, is quite slow to catch up with technology. This issue, and I think Aaron would say, although I'll ask, is not an issue that is front and center with the courts now, but it's something that we do need to think about. And part of my interest in this area at a personal level, aside from the fascinating technology, is the idea that the law needs to start thinking about these things now so that when these issues arise, the law and policymakers are not caught off guard. No court, no policymaker is going to be able to think this through ex post without having some experience, but still we can begin the conversation. And so Aaron's work, I think, is very forward thinking, but also very important as we think about the abilities of computers and how the law should react to them. So I'm excited to have Aaron on the show today. He is, as I mentioned, a special counsel in Maslin's Business and Security Group. He's an IP attorney with a strong information technology background and has quite a bit of experience advising clients. He focuses on intellectual property in the software, patent, and trademark areas. He also, as I mentioned, has worked on a variety of projects as a research fellow at Stanford Law School's Law Science and Technology Center through the Center for Computers and the Law. I became familiar with CODEX, the entity, when I was a fellow at CIS and got to know and admire the work of someone who's now a friend of mine, who's a former fellow, Harry Serdin, who is now at the University of Colorado. So I was excited to speak to Aaron last year at this point at Stanford and invite him on the show, and he graciously accepted. He is joining us via Skype from his office in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He has also been a very patient guest as we have faced a variety of technical and other challenges. So, Aaron, I thank you profusely for being on the show today, and thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Dave.
Let's start off, Aaron, with a general question I ask of most of my guests. Talk a bit more about your background and how you became interested in artificial intelligence.
It started with taking a look at terms of use and specifically browser app agreements and the issues that courts were looking at when faced with the prospect of bots or all kinds of different automated tools crawling on different websites and basically scraping HTML or other code from from competitor websites. And what intrigued me was that the courts were, even though they were clearly facing a situation where the bad act, so to speak, was conducted by automated tools, the courts were still insisting on looking at the presentation of the terms of use. And they were looking at the traditional things like layout, how conspicuous the terms were, the users have noted, you know, the kind of things that anybody that deals in this area is very familiar with in terms of the typical things that courts look at. And I started asking the question of colleagues. I was involved and still am involved with the Cyberspace Law Committee for the ABA. And I was asking the question of why are the courts insisting on looking at these issues or at these features of websites when it is so clear that this is not what is going on. The people who are sending these bots, are using these bots, clearly don't care that the website has terms of use, and they don't even if they cared, they wouldn't even read them. And obviously they don't care because they are using bots to scrape this information out. And I started thinking about what if we had a better tool to manage this? And because clearly I was disappointed with how the courts were dealing with it. And I started thinking about artificial intelligence. And I said, well, suppose that websites would have tools that were, in a sense, artificial intelligence driven. And these tools would be the go-betweens, the mediators, the gatekeepers, sort of an Uber robots.txt type of a feature. And they would be basically determining what a visiting bot would be or not be allowed to take or use. And that's what got me going on this topic. And I started talking to some folks at Stanford, most notably Mark Lemley and Roland Vogel and Josh Walker, and I think, yeah, those three. And it was very clear that the proper place for this type of research would be at Codex. And the project has since grown just from looking at browser apps and things like that. My research is all-encompassing, I would say, on the issues relative to artificial intelligence and what are the legal implications of using artificial intelligence. It's not just in the cyber world, but also in the cybernetic setting, so looking at the aspects also from a robotics perspective. So
let me ask you this, Iran, before we kind of set the stage by talking at a top level about what AI is, and I'm going to use that acronym for the remainder of the interview, artificial intelligence and the capabilities and limitations that currently exist. But again, by way of background, I mentioned Codex a little bit. You mentioned Codex. Why don't you tell the audience, for those that aren't familiar, a bit more about Codex and its place at Stanford and the kind of projects it works on?
Codex is, I would say, they call themselves, or we call ourselves, a multidisciplinary laboratory, and it really is that because we bring a lot of different people with different strengths, backgrounds into the center. And, you know, so we have people who are lawyers, people who are technologists, people who are in the entrepreneur world, people who are former Google engineers, obviously academics. So we have strong participation, and it's a joint center with the Stanford Computer Science Department, and so it's a very interesting synergy that happens when you take lawyers who have a passion for technology, and then of course you take the people who actually do this stuff of coding and making artificial intelligence applications, which are the people at the computer science department, at prominently Mike Genesareth, who is the research director for Codex.
And so the center itself, and then to be clear, you are a full-time practicing attorney, and so you do these projects through Codex. And I guess my last question, by way of background, is are you aware of other projects that are currently active in Codex or future plans?
There are many other projects at Codex. Mine is the only one that looks at the aspects of using artificial intelligence within the scope of the type of things that I write about in the blog. The use of, for example, Siri-like applications to deliver legal opinions and things like that. There are other very large and very advanced initiatives at codex, for example, issues about, for example, legal document management, and information retrieval systems, looking at computational law, making law more accessible to people, etc. So by no means is my research the only type of research that is going on at Codex, but I think it is the only type of research that is strictly married to AI.
So we're chatting with Aaron Kahana of Codex, the Center for Computers and the Law at Stanford, on Hearsay Culture and KZSU. And we are recording this interview on January 29th for airing at the end of the month, 2 days later. So, Aaron, let's take a step back at a top level before we get into these very vexing issues of policy and regulation. You know, many listeners, and certainly most people at this point, at least have a broad notion that there are computers that can think and reason. And there's logic. I think this issue was brought to the fore most recently on Jeopardy a couple of years ago at this point, where a computer was able to beat the reigning Jeopardy champion pretty handily, although that computer also came up with some funny answers as its logic failed to deal with the very issues that we're going to talk about today, I think, abstractions. But let's start at a very top level. What is, and I'm going to ask this broad question, what is artificial intelligence? How do you define it?
Wow. How long is this show?
Yeah, exactly. I'll answer the three or 4 minute version of a broad definition before we narrow it down a bit.
Well, I it's problematic because there's a lot of different, I think, perceptions of what artificial intelligence is. I think for the purposes of my research, and I'll just talk about that. I think the concept of artificial intelligence is using very intelligent machines that are capable of not only delivering data, but also learning as they go, and learning from their experience, learning from their environment, and being able to take that learning and apply it in a contextually intelligent way to their mission, to what they were designed to do. It gets more problematic, and I purposely do not want to get into the issues of what can happen down, you know, with AI going bad and things like that. I mean, we can talk about it, but I think it kind of takes us a little bit away from the research, the academic aspects, and more into the pop culture aspects, which may be for a different show, but maybe not for this one.
Right. So when we think about artificial intelligence, we are talking about computers designed to think, but I will avoid those you know, you're right, these entertainment based notions of computers run amok, and ask you a more perhaps a more boring question, but I think a more relevant one. What are these applications these computers currently being used for? What kind of uses do they have at the moment?
Well, that too is there's a long list of those things. You know, from a very, very alpha level type software perspective, you have Siri, that is a form of AI. It's a very early iteration, and I think that we are going to witness not just Siri, but variants of Siri. So, you know, whatever Google comes up with and things like that. But I think that we are just seeing the very beginning of applications that are able to deliver data in very, very creative manner and anticipate a user's requirements based on history of interaction with that particular user. On a more grander scale, you have, you just mentioned Watson and that computer's participation in a Jeopardy program. But Watson today, and this is not my part of my research, but this is just stuff that I read about, but the concept or the principle of what Watson is being used in the medical field to deliver very quick analysis of different medical maladies and being a first stop for doctors to be able to present a diagnosis on a patient. There really is a very long list of things that AI does, but I think that, you know, for users like myself, for example, and I'm purposely, by the way, I should say this, I'm purposefully not getting into this whole issue of AI in the military and drones and things like that. I think there's plenty written about that. And I think that is, it gets a little bit too, for at least for my academic taste, it's a little bit too heated. It's quote unquote too spicy. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at more of the applications that, for example, would make the law more accessible. When I talk about computational logic, for example, or computational law, I'm looking at those applications that can go out and search vast amounts of legal information and deliver it to users in a very, very succinct and easy to use manner.
Let me ask you this, Eric, because you've said this a couple of times with regard to the topics that you don't want to discuss, and I'm not going to backdoor now and ask you a question about it. I'd rather like to ask you a bit more about your reasoning, because clearly, you know, you mentioned drones and these other scenarios, but of course that is a moral quandary, perhaps it's an ethical quandary, it's a regulatory quandary, and I guess my question is this: your research doesn't focus in those areas, but yet can you think through these issues and particularly, as we're going to get to shortly, what the law should look like without at least being aware and cognizing and recognizing those boundaries? So how do you draw the line in your own research?
Well, I think that I just, not to be flippant, but I just really don't get into the discussions of, you know, the use of these advanced military applications in what I look at. I think that there's enough people, and part of the reason I don't do that, I think there's a lot of attention on it already. What my thoughts are won't, as far as I can tell, won't add anything to the discourse. The issues of whether or not it's right to have a drone take out a target that it has decided that fits certain parameters, okay, we can debate whether or not that it's moral. But for the purposes of Codex, for the purposes of what Codex is about, and a little bit more broader, the Law, Science, and Technology Center at Stanford, I don't feel that my participation in that discourse would be of particular value nor of particular interest to myself. So the boundaries drawn, to answer your question, really, it's very clear that I just say I'm not dealing with the military applications. That's okay. Not something I want to deal with. Can the law deal with them? Yes, of course. You've got, look at the military code of justice. You can look at, to the extent of criminal law. You can look at all kinds of different laws and say, okay, how would they deal with this? And of course, in the sense of drones and things like that, you have a very clear, agent working here, not in the sense of the law of agency, but the military is the tool being used to send these drones to carry out these missions. Mm-hmm. So from the perspective of the Codex research, those areas are really of not that relevant.
Mm-hmm. And so taking that perspective, I'll ask you one more broad question. What is the current state of the research? In other words, how, you know, to use a imprecise term, how abstract, if you will, can computers get today? I'm not asking you to pull out a crystal ball, but rather tell us about the current state of the technology and of the research.
Well, I wrote about this not too long ago about what's also called unsupervised learning, and it was an experiment that was conducted at Stanford and Google. And basically consisted of a neural network that encompassed 16,000 computers that were shown 10 million cat images. The researchers never labeled any of the images as a cat, but these computers or this network was independently able to construct the image of a cat from what was really an abstract conceptualization. So is that the state of the art? It's one of the state of the arts. I also wrote about hive structures of cyber quote-unquote organisms that are able to protect vast computer networks. This whole concept of using these types of again, the hive metaphor comes into play of these little worker bees that are able to protect the nest from, worms and other types of maybe Stuxnet-like type organisms, again, in quotes, is, I think, it's not part of research so much, but I think it's part of what is actually being done. And if anybody reads the Codex blog, they can, you know, read more about it over there.
And so when we're talking about the current state of AI, we're not dealing with situations where the imminent use of these computers in everyday life is happening. Or am I wrong in saying that? By everyday life, I mean you're in your run of the mill day. You're going to work. You're feeding your family. You're watching TV. How much interaction will you have, if any, with AI?
Are you talking about today?
Today, literally today. Okay. Yeah, like I said, I'm not asking you to pull out the crystal ball.
Yeah. Well, I can't speak for all the applications, Dave. I can tell you that I see Siri, for example, as an AI, and people may say, well, he's completely wrong, but I think Siri is a form of AI today. It's a very limited, very primitive, relatively speaking, to what will be. But it is, I think, the most promising, at least from my research perspective, a tool that is available to anybody who has an iPhone. And I know that I think Google Voice is similar. I've not actually used it, but I know that Google, obviously, now that they are working directly, I think they hired Ray Kurzweil to be on their staff in terms of developing future technologies. Or I can't remember the exact title that he has there. But I think that you will see Google playing a major role in the development. But again, more directly to your question, day-to-day stuff, I mean, we've got Siri. Are there other applications that are using AI? Possibly. I'm just not aware of the whole list of types of AI out there.
Sure. We're chatting with Aaron Kahana of the Mazzone Law Firm and fellow at the Codex at Stanford on KZCU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, yeah, let me the last top-level question, Aaron, and I appreciate you doing this for the listeners who aren't familiar. So, yeah, you and it's something I wanted to get to. So Siri is a form of AI. I would imagine, colloquially, the pushback on that would be, look, I mean, what you're doing with Siri is merely vocalizing a search term that you could type into Google and get the same results. What makes, in your mind, Siri a form of AI?
I think that the ability to decipher a little bit beyond just find me the nearest sushi restaurant, the ability to go a little bit beyond that, or and if you look at some of the patent applications that Apple is putting out, some of the broader things that they're thinking about for this technology, it becomes clear that Siri is much more than just a search tool with which you use your voice. And the integration with Wolfram Alpha and Nuance Technologies and those things. Again, as I said, it would be unfair to say today that Siri is AI. It's a form of AI. It's a primitive form of AI. And primitive, I don't mean to be detracting from it. It's just that it's very, very new. And it's not in what we, when I spoke at Stanford and when you attended my talk on that, we were talking about, the Prometheus, type of Android that is indistinguishable from a human being. So we're not even close to that kind of stuff yet. But if we're looking at what is it that we have today and how is it impacting our lives and how will it be impacting our lives? So Siri is definitely something that if you've used it and you start to rely on it, you can see where it's going. And that's really what I'm after. I'm not so much judging and saying Siri is AI today. I'm saying Siri is a sort of AI today, and it's really got a lot of promise.
We're listening, and you are listening, to Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford. For those of you that listen regularly, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage and click on donate to KCSU. Regardless, I hope you continue to listen to the show. So, Aaron, let's get now deeper into the research you're doing. And you've mentioned the phrase a couple of times. Again, as an academic, I want to make sure I'm defining terms. What is a definition of abstract conceptualization?
I think one way to think about that is the again going back to the whole idea of the unsupervised learning being the idea that that a for example let's go back a little bit. We know through research, and this is not something that I research, it's available out there. We know that repeated exposure to an image of an object will lead a young child to learn and more quickly identify what that object is before learning what the word for it means, okay? And so, again, going back to this thing that I talked about, the research that I referenced that was conducted by Stanford and Google, they basically took that concept and applied it to see basically whether or not the power of learning, this abstract conceptualization, which is this power of learning, was it something that is really the exclusive domain of humans, or is it something that computers could also do? And that's the unsupervised learning experiment that I had mentioned earlier that involved showing the neural network 10 million cat images, but never telling this neural network what this was. And so that's the idea, is taking very large data sets and being able to actually allowing the system to basically form in a conclusion about what that data set is. And it doesn't have to be just one answer, just that, for example, in the Stanford and Google research or the experiment that they had, it was just dealing with a cat. But it doesn't have to be that way. This is just one of the research aspects that I pointed to introduce the concept of abstract conceptualization.
And so I want to make this point clear. Where does this concept of Siri fit in the panoply of what you define as artificial intelligence? I don't mean just primitive, but in terms of its goals, its objectives, its ultimate ends. I mentioned Watson, you mentioned Watson. So when we think about abstract conceptualization, does it go as far in terms of its goals as literally what the human brain is capable of doing? Or are we going beyond that, beyond current and existing human capabilities?
Well, I think that when I looked at, when I presented this whole issue of abstract conceptualization, what I was looking at or what interested me was whether or not you could use that that principle or this unsupervised learning capability for an AI. And it doesn't have to be Siri. I mean, we don't need to, latch on to Siri. It's not the end-all type of AIs. It's just one very prominent type of AI. But there will be other tools, if you want to call them apps or whatnot, but these AI apps, they could, for example, with large data sets, these types of environmental learners, unsupervised learners, could basically, for example, engage in forensic analysis and detect instances of IP infringement online much more quickly and much more accurately than human beings could. They could detect online copyright infringement, if you want to get deeper into examples and like that. Even more sophisticated, they could maybe even get into pulling out evidence of patent infringement to the extent that some of these patents would be things that are happening online and not, machine-oriented and stuff like that, where we wouldn't have access necessarily to being able to decipher what is going on. So I think that the when you think about abstract conceptualization and where that could possibly lead to, I think is one area. And again, I just pulled IP infringement because it happened to be the topic of the presentation at Stanford, which is this is what this could do with this type of learning environment, with this tool, with this power that Ray Kurzweil has been talking about for so long. the technical feasibility of getting to these points is becoming more realistic with every passing day, month, whatever, you know, on this timescale that we're operating. And if you do subscribe to what Kurzweil talks about, and I do, in my research, I frequently mention his work, and I really think that his observation, and basically what he says, is that most long-range forecasts of what is technically feasible in the future, really, they dramatically underestimate the power of future developments. And I think this is extremely instructive in looking at what is very basically in the near term, in the next 5 to 10 years, quite possible with the kind of tools that we use. And these will be apps, you know, if we want to look at more practical aspects of this, these could be apps that will be residing on one's smartphone. And I'm not, you know, I have an iPhone, but I'm platform agnostic. So whatever platform will be the platform will be the platform that has the most users, and the most user will be using these tools in one way or another. Now, this is not going to be something that you'll download at the Apple or Google App Store for 99 cents necessarily, but these will be tools that will be used by businesses and governments and probably other types of users that I have not yet contemplated.
So that leads to where I wanted to go, which is the logistics of this. So we envision a scenario where there's an app, let's say, that is capable of detecting, or identifying indicia of behavior that would lead to the potential for being liable for copyright infringement. And you know, it seems pretty clear to me that what consumer would have any interest in downloading this app at all? Why would I want something on my phone monitoring my behavior that way? So my first reaction, or my first question, really is that: are we looking and are we thinking about these apps from the perspective of enforcement? Or do they serve? Could they serve other purposes in your mind? My follow-up question, incidentally, is going to be: tell me about the logistics. Literally, how? What are the steps necessary to get to the point where that behavior is there? Who's using the apps? How do they get into the system? And what are they sniffing? So I'll start with that first question, which is: what's the interest of the consuming public, for example, in these kinds of technologies?
Well, when we talk about the consuming public, I don't necessarily talk about, you know, the casual user of an iPhone or an Android-based phone. I'm talking, it could be law firms, it could be government agencies, police forces, it could be all kinds of different consumers, not necessarily consumers in the the regular sense of the word, people who download apps for 99 cents, et cetera. So the consumers for this could be different types of, not necessarily the individuals, bottom line. I don't think these apps, to your question on enforcement, I don't see these apps being enforcers, but I will say this. They could be enforcers with respect to, and this ties back into what started all my research at Codex, they could be enforcers in the sense that they would prevent or basically take, you know, some sort of a offensive action against an intruder to a website or a network. They could, for example, delete the other, the offensive worm, for example, or whatever it was. So there could be some level of enforcement like that. But I don't see right now, in terms of what I'm looking at in my research, I don't see enforcement in the sense of, sending a subpoena or, that could be something that would be down the road. Automated tools like that, you know, they would detect infringement automatically, you know, they send out a cease and desist or some other legal tool that would be available for them. But I don't see that as enforcement. Again, tying back to the Codex mission, it's about making information accessible. So it's not enforcing rights against infringement. It's more alerting to infringement in ways that are more automated, more accurate than current human beings are able to do. And basically also looking at vast amounts of data that people are not able to do without, obviously, the assistance of these types of applications.
We're chatting with Aaron Kahana of the Mazin Law Firm and fellow for the Center for Computers and the Law at Stanford on Hearsay Culture and KZSU. So, you know, to drill down on this point a bit more, Aaron, you know, we have and what's being used in Europe, for example, is this concept of graduated response with regard to copyright infringement. This notion that private entities, right, you know, the internet access providers and others are now invested by virtue of an agreement with the content industry to begin warning their users when they believe, that is, the internet access provider believes that copyright infringement is an issue. And so this graduated response notion is that there is a series of increasingly dangerous warnings that can lead to certain results, from you're being warned that you're doing this to, if you do it again, we're going to throw you off the network, to the authorities who be involved, and so forth. And so far, the early data that I've seen indicates that it's been fairly successful, and that by the third of the six possible warnings, according to one study I saw, 90% of the people receiving these responses or these notices actually changed their behaviors. Now, whether and this is my question, whether those notices are accurate is one of the big challenges. And of course, as you know, and as listeners to Hearsay Culture know, there have been a wide variety of battles with regard to copyright and other intellectual property infringement regulation, from the Stop on Run Piracy Act to the International Level Act and TPP, where one of the concerns is that the people writing the regulations are writing them specifically vague, or purposely vague, I should say, or not being transparent, with a goal of using these laws to not just shut down legitimate examples of copyright infringement, but fair uses and other uses that the owners of the content prefer that people don't do, but that the law currently doesn't cognize as a right that the content owners have. All of that background is by way of a specific question. You wrote that these kinds of artificial intelligence, abstract conceptualization applications could detect instances of IP infringement more quickly and accurately than humans. Talk to me a little bit more detail about that and whether this fits in with the general private enforcement regime, that I've mentioned.
Well, it's a loaded question in a way.
It absolutely is, and that's why I want your reaction to it.
Yeah. I think they can do so more accurately. But the question of whether or not people will agree that it's more accurately will be really a track record issue. Whether or not, you know, over an instance of, let's say, 100 cases where an AI app took the action of detecting or alerting to infringement, and you could say that, you know, in those 100 cases, this would be, you know, an empiric analysis. So in those 100 cases, really, in fact, the app got it much more correct than the human did. Now, you know, in fair use and things like that, there's a great degree of judgment, and, you know, two lawyers could disagree what is fair use. And I just attended a presentation by somebody from the studios, a lawyer from the studios who, you know, if you believe what the studios are saying, fair use is very limited. And of course, there's other lawyers on the other side who say, no, fair use is much broader. So I think humans disagree on what fair use is, but I don't think I would necessarily task an app with deciding whether fair use is this excusable as an instance of fair use or not. I haven't really thought about that. I guess it's possible by giving it, you know, 100 different or 1,000 or 10,000 different instances of what fair use is, and letting it distill from those instances a common denominator of what would or would not be fair use. You know, you could give the app exposure to Family Guy and show the app, you know, all of the things that Family Guy does that would be, you know, considered fair use, and then say, all right, scour it for other instances of similar use of brands and things like that, or references, and are these really do they fit? I mean, I'm just giving one example of a show that makes a lot of use of fair use. You could get really, really creative with the power of AI as long as, you know, it follows in step with the technical developments, and especially as we look at a little bit down the road, you know, 15, 20 years from now, with respect to the computing power that will be available at that point, and what kind of sense they would be able to make from extremely large data sets. You could, for example, give the app exposure to case law and say, all right, here's a repository of case law that talks about copyright infringement, and it talks about fair use and all the defenses and whatnot, and let it distill that information and develop rules for whether or not specific other instances fit or don't fit what is going on in the online world, for example.
And that's, you know, and where you're going is what I was thinking about as I was reading your work and thinking, actually, this is something I may want to write about in, you know, more along the lines of an essay than anything longer, that given, how the public choice issues involved in current IP lawmaking, given, as you mentioned, the divergent opinions on what fair use is, and this is, of course, the key caveat, a properly programmed application, might very well be preferable to human beings making these decisions. That this current state of affairs is such that I'd rather have an abstract conceptualization done by a computer program than by a human being who's going to be subject to a variety of influences that the computer may not cognize. And your reaction to that?
Well, I do want to mention there's something that when you start getting into this area of research, there's a lot of people that start talking about human intelligence, and for lack of a better term, it's a deep-seated idea. I can't think of a different word for it, but it's the deep-seated idea that human intelligence is a must, and it is almost astonishing, because when you think about human intelligence, there's really not anything astonishing about it when it comes to the things that we're talking about. For example, detection of infringement and things like that. You know, and I wrote about this some time ago. I wrote about the fact that you can have, in a legal process, for example, you could have two lawyers arguing a case on behalf of their respective clients, and they're collecting and distilling vast amounts of data, and they're issuing complaints and counterclaims and motions and whatnot from all of this data, and they are arriving at different conclusions in service of, to their clients. Okay, now, there is no real way to say that any single piece of advice that these lawyers rendered can be objectively categorized as quote unquote low quality if it fails to yield a legal victory, because we know that there is the possibility of appeal. So low quality may switch once there's an appeal and there's victory after the appeal. So the idea that human intelligence is the must have for these types of applications, I think, is going down the wrong road. And I think it actually puts people almost in a defensive, because there's this almost moral argument that, well, these things really, they are things. They cannot have human intelligence. So I'd rather say, you know what? Human intelligence isn't all that great when it comes to these types of applications.
Mm-hmm. We're chatting with Aaron Kahana of the Maslin Law Firm and fellow at Codex on KZSU-FM Stanford. Aaron, we are now in what I call the unfair portion of the show, although you may consider the entire interview unfair given the questions I've asked. But now I really am saying that there is a short amount of time, and I try to circumscribe my questions, but occasionally we'll miss the mark. So I do want to touch on something else that you referred to here and get into a little more detail in our remaining 8 or so minutes. there's a lot of talk now about big data and large data sets and the value of these data sets and the wonderful insights that can be reached and the technologies that, that you've written about that allow for the processing of this data. But I'm curious if you see or you have any concerns about the use of large data, or perhaps I'm going to use another loaded term, the worship of large or big data in light of the research that you've done and you're thinking about abstract conceptualization in AI. Are there any unexplored or not realized downsides to the use of these data sets in your thinking?
Well, I don't know if I have I don't subscribe to gloom and doom type of views on big data. It's here, it's unquestionably also here to stay, and it's only here to stay, and it's only here to grow. So big data is a fact. Now the question is, of course, how it's going to be used. Well, I think that with, like anything else, AI applications can be used in a quote-unquote bad way to abuse large data sets, and I think we will obviously, as the data, not the data, but as the computer power increases, you will have increased hacking capabilities as well, and people will be able to develop more intelligent AI applications to conduct the hacking that we see today. Maybe in retrospect we'll say, my God, look at how primitive it is. It's like watching one of those movies where they have very large cell phones and we just kind of wince in our seats. We're like, oh my God, look at the size of that thing. So I think the large data sets, for the most part, are not concerning to me. I think it's how they're going to be used. So I really say that as long as the overwhelming majority, the weight of quote-unquote good applications that are being developed to serve humanity, the data sets are there. There's nothing we can do about them. We can't extinguish them. So the question really will come back always to how are we using these AI applications to access these data sets. There's nothing we can do about removing them.
So that leads me, I think, to, and again, unfair question, Aaron, in the remaining 3 or 4 minutes, what to do? And I'm gonna, but more specifically from a policymaking or lawmaking standpoint, if you were, testifying in front of the appropriate panel in Congress, and Congress having, the uncanny and endless desire to regulate technology, what would you say right now? Should Congress do anything right now? Should it be thinking about this? What would you want, if anything, Congress to be doing at the moment?
Well, I think that I would want Congress to leave us alone. I think that this is an area, I'm not proposing that there will be no legal regulation of these activities, but I think that any regulation of these activities now, for example, putting a heightened liability on AI designers than software designers than on other designers, I think that would not be a good move. Also, I think it would be something that may not necessarily even be worthwhile of Congress's time, because people who want to develop bad applications would do so anyway. So that's not necessarily something that's going to stop them. But I think I would rather have an environment that fosters the creation of these types of applications. And basically, I would say that I would love to see a legislative environment or a congressional environment that allows to say, you know, as Steve Jobs said, the ones who are crazy enough to think that they can change the world are the ones who do. And I would love to have Congress stay out of that business and allow those people who are crazy enough to think that they can change the world to actually do that.
And so that leads to then my follow-up question, and my compliments for answering that question in a short amount of time, so it gives me room for one more unfair question. Are there positive things that Congress could do right now to support this research. In other words, there's the political football and the political tome of choosing a winner, right? The notion that if government invests in a particular technology, it's choosing a winner, which I always find interesting in light of the fact that it apparently chose a winner in investing in the internet, and I'm not sure that anyone's complaining too much if that came out of the Defense Department, at least right now. So the negative would be circumscribing behaviors, but is there anything on the positive side that policymakers could be doing or should be at least thinking about today?
I'm not an expert on policymaking, but to me, the whole issue of Congress being of playing a role in this area, to me, is maybe reducing the tax burden on people who invest in this, private individuals or institutions that invest in this area. Aside from that, I don't see how any type of legislation that comes out of these legislative bodies would actually help the development of AI. I think that there is enough private enterprise involvement in this, and aside from DARPA, I'm not even, like I said, I don't want to get into the military application so much, but I think that there is a lot of private, there's a great amount of private resources being that can be funneled into this, and as long as these types of investments are rewarded, perhaps maybe a lower tax rate for those types of investments, maybe that would be something that Congress could actually help with and say, you know what, we just want people to pour tons of money into this and build this up and see where we go from there. And then maybe you choose the winner because somebody will emerge as a clear victor, at least in periodic time frames. It's not you crowned once and that's it. I think there will be various different iterations of different players that will make it big, and some obviously will not.
Aaron Kahana of the Mazin Law Firm, as well as a fellow at the Center for Computers and the Law at Stanford University, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. This is obviously an issue, as you mentioned, which is in its infancy, and so I'm going to give you an open invitation on a going-forward basis to have you back in a year, 5 years, God willing, if I'm still here and the show's still on the air, to talk about these issues. But in the interim, thank you for being on the show today and certainly whetting the appetite of my listeners.
Thank you, Dave. My pleasure.
I'm excited to mention a number of upcoming guests on Hearsay Culture. The quarter has begun, and I'm in the process of recording a number of interviews. So among the people that are going to be on, in no particular order, but a general order, if you will, Vance Ricks of Guilford College will be on discussing his works on the morality and theology, if you will, of technology. Susan Chalmers and Ellen Broad will be on, who are internet policy experts and advocates in New Zealand and Australia, respectively. So they will be joining us on the show. Later on in the quarter, now by that I mean in late February into March, Dan Trottier will be on discussing his work, as well as Ron Epstein discussing his experience in the world of non-practicing entities, otherwise known as patent trolls. Ann Balsamo of USC will be on discussing her work. Dave Soibert of UC Santa Barbara, the librarian who inspired and runs the Cylinder Project, one of my favorites, where UCSB has digitized cylinders recorded between 1890 and 1920, and others will be on the show this semester. As the show is being recorded on Tuesday, January 29th, I am in the process of finalizing that schedule and plan to have it posted on hearsayculture.com. By the end of the day tomorrow at the latest, we'll be able to find this schedule. But we are starting off with Aaron Kahana and continuing through the quarter, which will end roughly at the end of March. As always, you have a couple of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show this quarter at 9 a.m. Pacific time on Thursdays on KZSU. You can also stream the show live at kzsulive.stanford.edu. Additionally, the show is posted as a podcast podcast by my friends at CIS, Elaine Adolfo in particular, who's doing that work. And that the shows post roughly a week after they air on KZSU, and you can get the show a number of ways via podcast. You can go to the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, where you can subscribe not only to Hearsay Culture, but to all events going on at CIS. You can also get the show by going to the webpage for CIS at cyberlaw.stanford.edu and going to our RSS feed or just downloading individual shows. And you can go to hearsayculture.com where you can get all previous 170-plus shows going back to mid-2006 as well as the upcoming schedule. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. So I'm excited to be back on the air this quarter. I will say as a personal note that last semester in particular was another very busy semester for me. I was tenured, thank God, and grateful for that in the spring of 2012 and properly in the fall of 2012, received the number of increased administrative responsibilities, which appropriately go along with having tenure, and so that kept me quite busy. And this semester those continue, but I intend to have a bit more balance. So I look forward to having a regular schedule going forward on Hearsay Culture. And I appreciate listeners' flexibility over the last really year as various other activities took away from having a fully regular schedule on the show. So that's behind us, and hopefully we're looking forward to a regular schedule here and going forward. So thank you for listening. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.